Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 7 in our Bible History and Customs series. And today we're going to deal with one of my personal favorite historical topics, and that is coins and money. Now, I want to first off apologize. I know that I've been noticing, checking the stats stuff on the website, that I've been getting some more downloads as of late, and it's been a couple weeks since I've been able to record and release a new episode. Good excuse, we got a new house, a mobile manufactured home, and which actually ought to work out good for the website and for recording, because we have an extra bedroom that for the foreseeable future will be a office slash school room for our kids. So very excited about actually having a place I can go shut the door and record if I choose to, if I'm able to. Because basically for most of the recordings I have done in the last, probably the last, anything I've done on here, probably in the last 5 years, the computer's been sitting in the living room or on the kitchen table or something. So I'm very excited to have an office to work in and stuff. So hopefully that will help me be able to release some more material, be a little bit more steady with producing new stuff. But, it's been a little crazy here of late. In fact, I've been looking just a few minutes ago for some stuff I could not find. It's still in a box over here beside me somewhere. But anyway, just want to go ahead and say that up front that, yeah, it's been a while and I apologize for that, but hopefully we'll get back on track. Well, anyway, let's get on with the lesson. Coins. I was bored one day at work. I was working at Legend Bank, and I hope I don't get in trouble and nobody up there listened to this, but sometimes those of us who worked in the computer room, we get a little bored and, you know, we'd play around on the internet. And I think that's any job that has a computer with internet access. Anyway, I was playing around on eBay and just got this idea. Thought, well, I wonder if you can actually buy like ancient artifacts online. And so I searched for like Roman artifacts or something like that. And I was surprised you actually can buy some stuff on eBay. I don't know if I necessarily recommend spending a lot of money doing it. There's a lot of fakes and stuff out there, but there is quite a bit of ancient items, antiquities on eBay. Just for reference, in case you didn't know, look it up. It's kind of neat. Little statues and little miscellaneous odd and end things. It's kind of neat. But anyways, I was digging around, looking at some of that stuff, I happened to stumble across ancient coins, and I was hooked. And this has been, it's been over 4 years ago now, but I really got into the ancient coins and started doing a little bit of collecting, and I don't know exactly how many. In fact, that's what I was looking for a few minutes ago, was my book that I've got all my coins in. You can go to, if you go to BaptistBasics.org, go to the articles section. There's a couple articles I've done on ancient coins. I've got some pictures of some of the coins I've collected, mostly, almost all through eBay. But anyway, I got into it, bought a few, and I don't know. I own a few dozen, I guess, now. I don't own a whole lot or anything really awesome or extraordinary, but it's just neat to me. To me, I like to call it tangible history, because you're holding a piece of an ancient empire in your hand, and it's not that the metal's really worth anything, or even that, you know, the pictures or stuff on it are necessarily even beautiful. In fact, most of the coins I can afford aren't in that great a shape, but it's just that tangible history when you're holding a coin that was from the Roman Empire, that, you know, there is a chance a Roman senator or a Caesar may have held that coin, that one of the disciples could have bought their lunch with that coin. You know, it's so interesting to think and to say that. To me, it's just that feeling of history that history lovers I know that are out there like me, you just get that feeling, because it's something you hold in your hand. It's not something in a museum. It's not something behind glass. I mean, it's just a little piece of metal with some pictures and some writing on it that's, you know, in some cases over, you know, 2,000 years old that you're holding in your hand, and you think of the history that that little coin could have seen, what it could have been through. You know, just it's amazing to think about. And actually, I'll tell you this, it's actually surprisingly affordable to get into collecting a lot of ancient coins. You're probably not going to get anything gold or maybe even silver, but you can buy a lot of old coins, a lot of them, you know, not very good shape, sometimes without even hardly pictures you can read on them. But you can buy those for just a few dollars sometimes. And in fact, when we get into some of the Jewish coins, you can buy Jewish coins for less than $20 on eBay in different places. So I may look back and laugh at that statement in a few years, but because the prices do seem to be going up a little bit as of late for a bunch of various reasons. But there's probably not been a better time and a lot better access to buy coins and to collect them. So something worth checking into. If you're interested, you can do a little looking on eBay for a lot of these. There's plenty of sites online that sell them also. So, just get out there and dig around. Be very careful though about buying it just because there are a lot of fakes and there's a lot of people that'll jack the price on them, just because, you know, well, it's historical, and they'll throw out the same, you know, touchy-feely things like I was talking about holding history in your hand. You know, well, people that are doing that, probably they're trying to cheat you. But anyway, coins and money. That's just my little personal introduction to the subject, is that I've got into it a little bit and found it very interesting. And what I want to talk about in this lesson is just kind of a broad overview of how coins were used, how they came about. And then we're going to narrow into the different coinage systems that the Jews would have come in contact with. And then we'll talk about the coins that the Jews themselves produced, and which mostly is the 2nd, 1st century BC, 1st century AD, that time period. There's only about 200 years there, I think, that the Jews were producing their own coins. So, anyway, let's get started. So it's amazing to think, but the first coins, really what we would consider coins, you know, little small things of precious metal with pictures on them, only came into being probably around the year 700 or 6th, 7th, 8th century BC, somewhere in that range. And there's actually a little bit of debate on the history. We'll talk about that in just a second. But what did they do before there were coins? We're so used to having coins and money and, you know, paper money and debit cards and stuff like that. Well, what did they do before that? You think about it, there's a lot of history, you know, that's a lot older than, you know, than 2,700 years. So what did they do? Well, basically it was a barter system. You know, hey, I'll trade you my cow for your two goats, or, oh, that's a nice rug. Tell you what, I'll trade you this barrel of apples for it. You know, that's the kind of thing that would go on as far as trade. Now, precious metals were used. Now, we do know that, you know, there were things like jewelry that would be used. In some cases, the precious metal and kind of the precursor to coinage as we know it, the precious metals would be formed into something like a bar or even a weight along the different standardized systems that were in place. And that's something I thought about getting into, but I may add another lesson on like weights and measurements and stuff. But basically they would form these into different bars and they could weigh them out. It was basically the weight's very important when you're dealing with it. Weight and purity are very important when dealing with precious metals, especially in the ancient world. So, you know, when they were trading, they would trade, you know, these little bars or weights of gold or silver or what have you for trade. So kind of like money that wasn't money, because it wasn't standardized, it wasn't mass produced. Now, the one thing that started to appear and kind of led to what we would consider modern coinage is that in some cases they would stamp these little bars or weights, and which meant something about the authority of who weighed the of who weighed it, and sometimes those would be, you know, different like cities or individuals. There's not a, really the whole weight system in the, these precious metals, these bars and stuff. There's not a lot known about them. A lot of it's conjecturing. We know a little bit more about the weights because they found quite a few of those. But as far as these bars, I mean, if someone found it, they're going to be melting it down and, you know, turning it into jewelry or even coins. So it's kind of difficult to tell, you know, exactly how these things were used. This is just kind of the general accepted history from what I understand is that, you know, yes, these precious metals were used. You know, they're often a bar or a ring or something like that. And but that sometimes they would have these stamps on them, just kind of approving, saying, hey, yes, we weighed this and it does weigh, you know, one shekel. So that's kind of how that worked. All right. Now, as far as the earliest coinage, there's a little bit of debate about exactly when and who and where this took place. And this is following, you know, kind of the Western civilization tradition. This may be one of those things where if we, I knew a little bit more about Chinese history, you know, well, the Chinese did it, you know, hundreds of years before. That's usually what happens. We'll say, hey, look, hey, we had this and, you know, 400 BC, you know, look what the Greeks were doing. And then somebody else said, well, the Chinese were doing it 200 years earlier. You know, well, but as far as coinage, this is basically the general accepted outline. There is one theory, a little less common, that the first coins came from an island called Aegina in the 700s BC, mid 700s BC. And that a little bit lesser known theory, the more generally accepted theory is that these came from the region of Lydia, which is up around, up in modern Turkey, in Roman times, like in Paul's travels and such. They're talking about like region around like Ephesus. But generally accepted, thanks mainly to the historian Herodotus, that this is where we think coins came from. There's a lot of historical evidence and archaeological evidence for this too, that this is where the, you know, these coins begin to appear. Most of the earliest coins were made of something called electrum, which is fascinating, and I want a coin made out of this just because it sounds so awesome, but they're very expensive. Electrum is a gold and silver alloy, so it's gold and silver mixed together. It's naturally occurring. They were getting it out of like rivers and stuff up there. But I mean, that's just, and you look at it, I mean, it kind of looks like a lighter gold, but it's just amazing. Gold and silver mixed together. It sounds so cool. The first person to mint these was probably a guy named, and I'm probably going to slaughter this, but a king named Aliates, something along those lines, who ruled between 610 and 550 BC. Some people say it was a little bit earlier than that, but most people claimed it was him. Now, this king, his son is a little bit more famous, especially was famous for being super wealthy. His name was Croesus or Croesus. I think Croesus is how you're supposed to say his name, C-R-O-E-S-U-S. And he was known throughout the ancient world for being super wealthy. In fact, it became a kind of a proverb, people saying he's rich as Croesus. So anyway, one of his claims to fame is that he paid for the building of the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, the original structure there. And the coins there, we'll get a little bit more into the different standards, but the coins there's relatively small. In fact, most ancient coins are pretty small by modern standards. And when you see a movie that, you know, that seems like they're throwing out these gigantic coins, you know, on the table that like size of it, like a half dollar or something. Well, most coins are actually smaller than a dime. They are very, very little. And honestly, there are some coins, and I own one of these really early Greek coins that probably could fit on the top of a pencil eraser. I mean, very small. But they ranged in size from what's considered a third stater, which, you know, I got thinking, I don't think I got into the stater. No, I didn't. But that's a Greek weight, and that's about 4.7 grams. And these would range down then fractionally down to something about a 1/96th of a state or so, 0.15 grams. I mean, the very, very small, thin, flat coins. And some of these also, you know, were silver, not a lot of gold, but mostly silver. Silver, very, very common in ancient coinage. In fact, real quick, and I'll talk about the different metals. Gold was pretty rare. Most people never saw a gold coin in their life, especially like under Roman times. Silver was very, very widespread. Part of that, you know, was the Greeks had a lot of good silver mines. It was a lot more abundant. So the common people would have used silver coins, especially these super duper small coins. And then other coins would be made out of things like copper and bronze. And those were way more common and usually of lesser value. And we'll get into the different value systems placed on these things. But usually gold coins were the top, and then silver coins were in the middle. And then, you know, had like copper and bronze coins would be the lower denominations. So the next section I want to get into is the different standards of coins, the main systems that were used by the Jews. I mean, we could get into, because of the trade and different things, we could get into a lot of different little offshoots of this. I mean, when you just talk about Greek coinage, we could talk about the classic Greek coinage, you know, the stuff that was minted up in like in Athens and stuff like that. Then we could talk about, you know, the different offshoots, especially, you know, post Alexander the Great. And then we could talk about different things that were also minted on the Greek standard of weights, but not necessarily Greek. I mean, so we could go on and on, but I just want to give you a broad overview of some of the different systems and weights and measurements and how they played in with the ancient Jews. Now, a major note I need to give is that ancient coinage systems changed all the time. They were constantly being revamped. Names were changed. Sometimes coins would just change names. It'd be the same coin, same weight, but they would just call it something new. Sometimes some coins had different names. Same coin, but, you know, it could be called, for instance, a shekel could be called a tetradram because it equaled 4 drachma. So these, just to make things more confusing, then weight and purity would often shift. So what you would do, this happened quite a bit with the Romans, where, you know, the economies go, you know, the economists will say, hey, we need a little bit more money in circulation. Well, we don't have any more, you know, silver. Well, let's just kind of mix in something else. And instead of it being 90% silver, we'll make it 80% silver and kind of stretch our silver out a little bit. And they kept doing that till at one point in the later Roman Empire, I mean, the coins, the so-called silver coins, a lot of times would be just like copper or brass or something, and would be what they call like a silver wash. I mean, basically just dipped it in silver, you know, just a silver, very thin silver coating on them. So that's it shifts throughout history. And so I'm just kind of giving a broad overview and trying to give something that would date to the proper times that, you know, Bible times, especially like the Roman Empire. We could talk about the early Roman coinage and then the Republican coinage. And then, you know, then when you get into the empire stage, Augustus set a standard, Nero changed it a little bit, Diocletian changed it a little bit. I mean, it's constantly changing. And then they would totally, you know, redo the system. And was it like the 2nd century? They basically just, you know, came up with a whole new system of coinage. And so, but we're going to just deal with how it pertains to Bible times. And I'm having a hard time explaining it because it is very difficult to understand. I don't think I have a very good grasp on it, but if you'll just go do a little research on it, everybody has a hard time explaining all these different things. And another thing I want to talk about is that when I'm dealing with this, I'm going to give just some basic denominations of these coins, and some of this is just that we've come up with later trying to classify them. We're not really sure exactly, you know, if they thought of, well, hey, look at this coin. This coin is, you know, It's not like today where, you know, our quarter says it's a quarter, our dime says it's a dime, you know, our penny says it's worth 1 cent. A lot of these coins, you know, it's just, hey, look, it's a little silver coin. So a lot of the value just goes on, you know, what it's made of and the weight of it. So, and then a lot of them also, there's a different fractional and multiples of these coins. So, you know, you can have a coin that, for instance, like a Greek dram. You could have one that's just a regular dram. Well, you can also have like a didram, which is twice the size of a dram, or a tetradram, which is four times the size. And then different fractional units. I mean, down to like we talked about with the Lydian coinage. I mean, 1/96th of a stater. I mean, super small coins. So, I'm basically just going to give, I'm not going into all the different, in fact, even with the Roman coinage, I think I'm only talking about 2/3 or so of the different denominations, because those are more common and relate to the Bible more than some of these other pretty rare coins and denominations. So we're just kind of going to keep it simple, give you an idea, an introduction to some of the terms and stuff. If you really get into this and want to study it out more, you're welcome to do that. But as I say, I'm just doing this all up front, because if someone were to listen to this that is a big coinage nerd, and I'm not exactly a huge coinage nerd, but if someone listens to this that is a collector, I don't want them to think, well, boy, he oversimplified. Yes, I am oversimplifying, just for the sake of making it simpler to understand to someone who has no idea what's going on with these coins. Okay. The first kind of system of coins that the Jews probably came in contact with, the Lydian coins would have been up in Turkey. They've been a little bit further away. So it's not something that they would have probably, and at least historically and archaeologically, we can say, you know, well, it's doubtful they had any interaction with them. Well, the kingdom of Lydia was conquered by the Persians. And we know that the Persians did have contact with the Jews, and there is, you know, evidence that the Persian coins probably were the first ones that the Jews came in contact with. Persian coinage is credited to Darius the First, who I think this is he lived these dates 522 to 486 BC, and what's called the, and I'm going to slaughter this one, but I think it's called the Achaemenid Empire, which is just the term for that period of Persian history. They have two main types of coins. There's one is called the derrick, and the derrick is a gold coin, and weighs about 8.5 grams, 8.4 is kind of a good number on that. Then the siglos is the other type of coin. It's made of silver. It's about 5.5 grams. The ratio would be that 20 siglos equal one derrick. So a 1-to-20 ratio between the gold and silver. These coins, the general design on these coins would be kind of what makes them famous, is there's like a king figure with a bow and arrow, and it's not really sure exactly, you know, who this guy is, but that's kind of the distinguishing mark on these. In fact, even later Persian coins would kind of go back to that symbolism of that, but it's usually like a king with a bow and arrow. Okay, so that's the Persian coinage. Now, the Greek coinage. And Greek coinage is very important. Basically, thank you, Alexander the Great, for conquering the world and spreading out the, you know, the Greek system of measurement and Greek coins and things like that. So, some of the more general types of Greek coins, we have the dram, which is spelled D-R-A-C-H-M, or the plural version of that is just add an A to the end, and then it turns from dram to drachma, is the way most people, I believe, say that. The dram was silver, weighed about 4.3 grams, and below the dram was the obol, which was also silver, weighed about 0.7 grams, and 6 obols made up 1 dram. And Greek coinage is very, very beautiful. A lot of beautiful pictures of goddesses and gods and portraits of figures and animals. A lot of people love the Greek coins just for the beauty of the coins. And honestly, as someone who's looked at a whole bunch of coins, you know, online and books and stuff, a good quality Greek coin is one of the most beautiful things you will see if you appreciate, you know, ancient art. They are just beautiful coins. But the Greek coins were produced by different city-states just kind of throughout the Greek world. So I'm saying Greek coins. I'm not necessarily saying that they were produced in Greece. Greek, quote-unquote, coins could be produced throughout the world, you know, out the ancient world. So some of these coins on these standards could be produced in, like, you know, in Judea and even in, like, Egypt. And, you know, we see these types of coins, these types of weights and measurements throughout the world. The other thing I want to mention with Greeks is they didn't just produce silver coins, and there even was some gold coins. I didn't want to get into that, but they also produced some different like copper coins and other, you know, let's say less precious metals, like something like copper. And there's not a real good term that I can understand for these. I own a few, you know, like copper Greek coins and stuff. But a lot of times the term is given is just they're called chalkoi. And the kind of the general thing is that eight chalkoi equal one obol. But there's a lot of different coins and different weights and standards when you get into the Greek coinage, even with the copper coins. But that's just kind of a general rule of thumb, just to kind of keep in mind on the values. Okay, now that gets us as we're progressing throughout the, you know, the string of empires here, from the Persians to the Greeks. Now we're to the Romans, and Roman coinage is. Number one, the Roman Empire lasted forever, but number two, the Roman coinage changed all the time. I mean, it seems like every few decades, someone was tweaking it, and then every, you know, few hundred years, they were just totally redoing the system. So, a lot of these terms even, you know, have different meanings. Sometimes the coins were even made of different materials, so just for simplicity's sake, we're going to talk about what's kind of the early imperial coinage. These weights and measurements, I tried to follow those that were established by Caesar Augustus, and they would have been pretty much unchanged up until the reign of Nero. So these were kind of the first half or more of the first century AD is when these would have been the standard, which is, you know, the time when most of the New Testament takes place. So these should give you a good idea of references that may be in the New Testament to the coins being used. We'll start at the top. The Romans had a gold coin called the aureus, weighed about 7.7 grams, and these are extremely rare, and the common people usually didn't see these things. Next is way more common and was kind of the backbone of the Roman currency is the denarius. It's a silver coin, about 3.8 grams. Takes 25 of these denarii. I'm going to be all over the place with some of these, you know, when you deal with Latin, you know, denarius is singular, denarii is plural. I'm going to be all over the place. I might call them denariuses and stuff like that. I apologize if you're really, you know, particular about that. I just kind of do my best. But 25 denarii equal one aureus. So that's kind of the ratio, 25 to 1. Denarius is, I say, very widespread. These were the backbone of the currency. Silver coins, basically, if it's, well, and not only that, the denarius was used for centuries, in one form or the other, different weights and standards and stuff. So, and then even the name eventually, you know, kind of kept going on through language, and you can trace back a lot of names. Like there's the dinar that's sometimes used different places. And that actually goes back to, you know, trace its roots back to denarius, and a bunch of other different coin and monetary names can trace their roots back to the denarius. The denarius, basically, in the New Testament, where the word penny is used, that's denarius. So, and that's where you get into the modern American person is like, well, a penny, that's not very much, because that's, you know, 1/100th of a dollar. You know, that's worth nothing. That's our smallest coin that's produced, well, in modern times. But so you have to think, though, it's easier if you're like familiar with the British system and the British penny, because it's actually a silver coin, which actually kind of traces its roots historically and back up to the denarius. So when you see penny, don't think of American penny. You need to think of a British penny. That's the easiest way to explain that. But basically, penny in the New Testament is a denarius. It's the silver coin. Equating it to modern standards, I've heard people say, oh, it's worth, you know, $20 or whatever. I don't know. You cannot equate ancient systems to modern money systems. There's just too many different variables to come into play. And basically, you know, if you want a good measurement of what it's worth, just go by the weight of the metal content and, you know, put a value on that. That's probably the easiest way to convert that. All right, so I rambled a whole long time on denarius. The next one is a little bit more rare. I don't remember it being mentioned in the Bible, but in a lot of the historical books, you'll see it mentioned. And that is the sestertius. And this one, I know I'm slaughtering the pronunciation on. But when you're dealing with books, and most ancient sources and even modern history books and stuff, when they talk about values in the Old Testament and somebody giving so much money to someone else, a lot of times it's not in the form of you know, how many denarii that someone gives. It's how many sestertius or sestertia, or however you say that. S-E-S-T-E-R-T-I-U-S, you pronounce it. But it's usually in terms of the sestertius. So, you know, that's why it's very important to understand what this is, because, say, if you read almost any Roman history, it's going to come up. The sestertius was brass. Now, this is one of the cases where it changed, because pre-Augustus, it actually was a small silver coin, but after him, it became a large brass coin. In fact, very large, 22 grams, one of the largest ancient coins, and very popular with collectors because it's so big. The sellators, the people who engrave the coins and stuff, had a lot more room to work, so they're often very beautifully engraved, especially for Roman coins. I mean, just very, very beautiful. So a good one in good condition is worth a lot of money. I do not have a sestertius because they're pretty rare, and like I said, they're pretty collectible if they're in good shape. As far as value, four sestertius or sestertii equal one denarius, so 4-to-1 ratio. Next, you have the dupondius, which is a brass coin also, weighs about 11 grams, and two dupondius is something like that. Two of those equal one sestertius. Boy, I'm slaughtering the Latin names today. Next, and this one is used in the New Testament quite a bit, and that is the AS. And sometimes it's called, I think it's Assyrian. Sometimes you see it's like a Greek form and enlargement of the name. But the AS is a bronze coin, weighs about 10 grams. And so what's the difference between it and the dupondius is basically brass and bronze. But it's a bronze coin. As far as value go, two ases equal one dupondius, and 16 ases, I don't know, I don't even know how you do that one, equal one denarius. So 16-to-1 when you're changing it to denarius. Okay, then the smallest coin we'll look at is the quadrants. And this will come important a little bit later when we get into some of the Jewish history. But the quadrants is one of the smallest, if not the smallest, Roman coin that was produced. Bronze, about 2.5 grams. So you can tell by the weight, the ratio on it is pretty easy. 4 to 1 when you're converting quadrants to an as. And it's also easy because of the name quad. You know, it's basically a quarter, you could say. It's a quarter of an as. So that's a good overview of the Roman coinage. And like I say, this changes throughout history. That just will kind of give you a good understanding of what you need to know for the Bible, and even give you a good idea, even if you're reading Roman history from the first few centuries, BC, first century AD, that'll give you a good idea of values and stuff. Okay, now on to Jewish coinage, ancient Jewish coinage. The Jews themselves, because of where they are on the trade routes and stuff, they had a lot of foreign money going through and in trade. Archaeology, proves that. But they did produce some of their own coins. Now, the earliest coin, and there's some debate on this about exactly what these are, but there are some very small coins that have been found that date back to about the 4th century BC, and they're called the Yehud coins because of abbreviation that's on there, which they believe stands for Yehuda or Judah. And these coins are very small. These are very, very small coins, but they're very rare. Minted, it appears throughout different areas of Judea, up into Samaria. And what the common theory is on these is that these were probably like Persian or Greek coins, or minted under Persian and Greek authority. Let me go and explain this too. A lot of times what you do with like an empire type state, like the Greeks, not necessarily the Greeks, but like the Romans or the Persians, a lot of times the empire itself would reserve the right to produce the larger coins, our precious metal coins, we could say. They would produce the gold coins, they would produce the silver coins, and they wouldn't allow other people to produce those most of the time. But they would be a lot more free with letting who would produce, the smaller denomination coins, the copper and brass, bronze type coins. So in a case like this with the Yehud coins, and I'm probably slaughtering that pronunciation too, you have a case where, say like the Persians probably, they're going to be the ones doing their derricks and their siglos and stuff like that. But, who cares if, that little local place over there wants to make a quarter of a siglos, who cares? That's great. So let them do their thing. But, if they started producing, if this local entity started producing, the full value, full size coins, full size derrick, well, then there's going to be problems because that's a sign of independence. This was kind of one of the things you can tell, subjugation and stuff of different areas by the size of their coins, and then privilege of areas, because if they were allowed to produce, even just produce silver coins or large silver coins a lot of times, because basically Rome, if it wasn't produced in Rome itself or some of the other mints there, around like Italy and a few other places, other places could produce some denariuses and stuff, but for the most part, local provincial coinage, a lot of times what it's called, is bronze or brass or copper. It's usually not very large coins. They're usually smaller denominations. In American terms, this would be like saying, okay, someone, Texas, you can produce your own pennies and your own nickels, but the federal government is producing, dimes and quarters and dollars and stuff like that. But then they'll say, well, Florida, we like Florida better than Texas. I don't know why somebody would, but Florida, we like you better, so you can produce quarters and half dollars. But, no one besides the federal government is allowed to make dollars. And that kind of would be a way to illustrate the way it would work with a lot of times with these ancient coins. So anyway, the Yehud coins, There's not a lot of difference between these and other kind of provincial type coins. They're very similar to some of like the Greek and Persian coins that you see. There's some changes on them. Some people say may represent God or things from the Bible. There's a case where I think there's a chariot. There's one that's a picture of somebody's ear, and they think, well, maybe that's, you know, representing God, you know, and hearing everybody's prayers and stuff. But a lot of it's kind of a stretch. We don't know. There's a lot of mystery, and actually a lot of advancement in what we know about these coins has just taken place in the last few decades, and some new finds and some new theories have come out. And I mentioned something there I want to talk about real quick, which is very important when you're dealing with Jewish coins. You might remember one of the Ten Commandments talks about not making any graven images. Well, if you're going to make coins, what are you going to put on them? And basically the Jewish thought was in the matter was that you didn't make images of people or animals, or try to make, you know, pictures of God. They would do pictures and decorations and stuff of like fruit, of plants, of different like implements in the temple. That was kind of okay to do. So when we deal with the Jewish coinage, almost none of the time, in very, very rare instances, is there somebody's picture on them like we're so used to today, and was very common in, you know, like the Greek standards. It would be, you know, they put a god or something on there. Early Roman standards, that's what they did too. Later, like Imperial Rome, a lot of times, you know, it was the emperor or, you know, somebody he liked, his wife or something like that. But when you're dealing with Jewish coins, it's almost always going to be things like a cornucopia. Oops, sorry about that. I forgot to mute the second track there with the out music. And we've gone a little longer than we did last time. So sorry about that. I'm not going to edit that out just so I embarrass myself. Anyway, so when you're dealing with Jewish coinage, you know, it's going to be pictures of plants. You'll be things like, I won't get too far ahead of myself, but sometimes there's anchors on them. There's pomegranates, or maybe like a star, a wheel, a cornucopia. There, some of the later like revolt coins would have pictures of things like that were supposed to be the temple. Or things in the temple. So, anyway, you know, when they dealt with the graven image, it wasn't that they couldn't produce any kind of picture. There were certain types of pictures they felt like they could not produce. So when you're dealing with Jewish coinage, that's one of the things that makes it so unique, is just, you know, there's no people's pictures on them. There's no pictures of animals on them. Okay, so that's the Yehud coins. I think I've covered everything we'll cover on those, about 4th century BC. The first really, authentic Jewish coinage based on a Jewish standard, minted by Jews under Jewish authority, comes from what we call the Hasmonean dynasty. And the Hasmoneans are the descendants of the Maccabees. Remember, the Maccabees revolted against the Seleucid Empire and reestablished an independent Jewish state in the 2nd century BC, which lasted a little over 100 years into the 1st century BC until King Herod. And the Hasmonean rulers, even as they started to kind of pull away from the Seleucids, there's actually a transitional coin, or a couple of them, that were kind of interesting, where basically, it's one side looks Jewish, unlike later Jewish coins, and the other side actually has like some of the Seleucid type imagery on it. And very interesting little coins. In fact, I actually do have one of those really early coins that are like that, kind of a transitional coin. And evidently the theory on that is that the Seleucids were trying to give them a little bit of independence, maybe to quell a little bit of the rebellion that was starting to happen, which didn't work. But anyway, the Hasmonean coins produced by these were produced by 164 to 35 BC. And two basic denominations, and there is debate on this, and they're wild all over the place. I'll talk about that in just a second. But two basic denominations that you'll see. The basic one is what's called the Pruta. Plural is Prutot. But the Pruta is a small copper coin at this time, weighs about 2 grams. And this is the basis for Jewish coinage. And the Pruta, there was some that was like multiple Pruta weight, I think up to like 8 or so. You know, one coin was worth 8 Pruta. Those are pretty rare. And then there's also a smaller half Pruta called a lepton, which is also, you know, copper, weighs about 1 gram. And basically, these are the most common Hasmonean coins, or Prutas and leptons. Now, the fun thing about this type of coinage, these are very small. They're not worth a lot of money. So they're, a lot of times they were more concerned with quantity instead of quality. So the weights are all over the place. In fact, there are some people that think there really is no Pruta and Lepton division, that there's just Prutas, and then there's Prutas that just were made a little bit too small. So it gets very, very difficult when you're dealing with all these with these standards. There's a few different theories on that. But basically, basically, the best way to think about these coins were mass-produced, they were cheap, and they didn't care what they looked like. They didn't care about making sure they weighed the same. So they are all over the place in shape and size. In fact, one of the ways they produced, a lot of times when they produced these coins, they would take, they'd make like a small, I think they called it like a flan, which is kind of basically just a, you know, little round coin-shaped metal, you know, without an image, put it in a die, or double-sided die, put it in between the two places, hit it with a hammer, and that would put the image on, you know, onto the coin. Dealing with these Prutas and Leptons and stuff, the Jews actually came up with a system where they would pour the molten metal into this deal, and would go down these lines and basically make a strip of these coins that were connected. And just kind of little round bumps, you know, on a long line. And then they would go through with their dies and stamp each one, evidently very quickly, because they're usually off-centered. It's very difficult to find one. You actually get the whole engraving on. In fact, a lot of times the dies were bigger than the little strips, so you don't even get the whole picture. And then they would chop these things off in between each other, which actually makes some of these coins look like bow ties, or even fish in some cases, because they chopped off a little bit too much. They got a little bit of the next coin. So, as I say, the thing about these coins, they were cheap, they were mass-produced, and they didn't care about the quality. So, they are all over the place in errors. You know, modern coinage, you know, it's a pretty good system, pretty good technology. If you find a coin, you know, that's got stamped twice, you know, and there's a double image of Lincoln's head on the penny, I mean, that's worth some money. When you're dealing with these ancient coins, actually, the better the quality of the coin, the rarer it is. So they're worth a lot more money. When you're dealing with these Jewish, the Hasmonean coins, it's rare to find one that's in really good shape, and they're worth quite a bit more money. These coins you actually can pick up, I mean, in some cases, for a few bucks a piece on places like eBay and stuff. And you may not be able to read the whole inscription. It may only have little parts of the picture on them because the, you know, whoever made it didn't align the dies right. But these are actually very, very affordable. If you want to own an ancient coin, these are pretty affordable. The only exception to that is that it's believed the widow's mite is probably a lepton, which it's hard to tell the difference between a lepton and a pruta. So what really makes these super collectible is the tie-in with the widow's mite, that, you know, what I talked about before, you know, that historical pitch where you say, well, you know, this could be the widow's mite that was thrown in. Well, whatever the case is, that drives a price up on them some, and the people who sell them as widow's mites will drive the price up. But you can get these things, especially there was a guy named, one of the Hasmonean rulers was a guy named Alexander Janaeus, and he produced tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of coins. And you can find his coins usually pretty cheap. And so anyway, interesting to look at. But if you're wanting a Jewish coin, this would be the first place to look because you can afford them. Plus, it very possibly, I mean, this is the type of coin that was the widow's mite. When I was talking about the poor quality of these, basically it got to the point where it wasn't so much that, oh, this is a lepton, this is a pruta, so this is worth twice this. No, it actually got to where it basically was based on weight. And some of these coins, even historically, were used up until like the 3rd century AD as small change, because small change evidently was pretty rare. So they were still using these things as currency, but they were using it just basically by the weight of the metal. And that's probably the best way to even worry about the value of these things is just to say, you know, well, it's worth its weight, because they're so all over the place with their with the weight content. So it's hard to place a denomination on them. And it's not like they wrote the denomination on them and said, hey, this is worth 1 pruta, this is worth 2 pruta, this is worth 0.5 pruta. You know, they didn't do that. So basically it just goes back to the weight anyway. So anyway, that's what you need to know about the Hasmonean coinage. There's a few different rulers. But if you see a widow's mite, what's claimed to be a widow's mite, it's going to be one of these coins. All right, the next little stage in Jewish coins is the Herodian coinage. And these were minted by the Herodian line, King Herod the Great and his descendants. And you can actually stretch this out pretty far and go in quite a bit through different rulers out of that line up into the late 1st century AD. But kind of as a classification, you know, we just kind of lump them all together. The earliest coins minted by King Herod, very, very similar to the Hasmonean coinage. A lot of the same symbols are used. In fact, those same symbols, like Hasmonean coinage, usually has like a wreath with an inscription, cornucopia with a pomegranate, and different ribbons and things like that. If you've seen one, you've seen them all, pretty much. There's not a lot of variation in them. There's a few different types, but the classic type, which has wreaths and an inscription on the other side, has double cornucopia and stuff like that. It is all over the place. I mean, even different rulers, basically you've just got to kind of decipher the lettering to figure out which ruler minted it, if you can even figure that out. So, but even Herod, he minted some that basically looked the same as the Hasmonean coinage. Then introduced some different symbols and stuff, and then the different rulers after him got away from it. They did pictures sometimes of ships, but usually stayed to the you know, following the no graven image deal, because they would have had a ride on their hands by the Jews. The one exception is Philip, that's mentioned in the Bible. He actually, because his kingdom there, or his area he ended up ruling, wasn't really populated very much by Jews, he actually put his face on some of his coins. So he's actually one of the few of the Herodians that we actually know what he looked like or have an idea of what he looked at because of the coins. Now, they did do a shift with the Herodian coins, because remember, King Herod came into power thanks to his buddies in Rome. And so they did eventually, and I don't know the exact date on this. I didn't really find it. I didn't take a lot of time to look for it. But there was a shift where they changed the kind of the system of measurement that they were using. So the pruta, what we would call a pruta, actually increased in size and became equal to a Roman quadrants. So they actually increase in size, and they're quite a bit bigger. I don't know the exact multiplication on that, but well, I can probably tell you 1 gram there to, yeah, 2.5 times or so. But I mean, they are noticeably, visibly bigger coins. So that that is one shift that began to take place, not necessarily with Herod, but his descendants, you begin to see that. Which kind of leads us into the next little stage of what we consider Jewish coinage, which is actually Roman coinage, Roman provincial coinage. But that's the what we would call procurator coinage. And these were minted under authority, locally minted under authority by the local Roman rulers. So number of guys, we know many of these, Coponius, Marcus Ambivalus, Valerius Gratus, Pontius Pilate, Antonius Felix, Porcius Festus. And if you some of those names sound familiar, yeah, they ought to. They're mentioned in the Bible, and you can get coins minted by these people. Pontius Pilate, those are pretty collectible. I'll warn you, the prices on those go way up. I have one, and it's not in good shape because they are very difficult to get. Let me ramble a little bit on this. Pontius Pilate coins, part of what makes them so rare, you can thank the Shroud of Turin for that, which I don't know what to think about that thing. I want to say it's a fake, but evidently, if you look at the eyes on the Shroud of Turin, where the eyes are on the image on it, you can make out what looked to be like coins of Pontius Pilate, very specific ones that have what's believed to be an augur's staff on them. And very interesting. Pontius Pilate's coins are very interesting. He actually kind of got a little bit in your face with the Jews. And his coins, he actually put some images on there, like the augur's staff, the augurs being like the fortune teller priest people that, you know, would by flight of birds and bird entrails and stuff like that would divine the future. He put one of their staffs on the coin. So that's something that the Jews probably wouldn't have liked. So evidently that's kind of a mark of his rule, is that he didn't get along well with the Jews and he wasn't about to compromise with them or really even care what they thought. So, but anyway, but Felix and Festus, there's a bunch of coins that they have them. They may not necessarily have their names, but they will have a date on them, or, you know, through the old dating systems. And so we can kind of date them and we can, you know, we know that, okay, well, this date has to match with this procurator. So, you know, that's who it is. So it's not necessarily that these things have their names on them. In fact, I don't remember that they do. But interesting, actually, one of the rare coins, well, the cheapest coins you can get with Nero's name on it is actually one of these procurator coins, because it actually has Nero's name on it. So anyway, interesting stuff. And these, there's a bunch of different types of these. They're fairly affordable until you get to the Pontius Pilate coins are way expensive. But, well, way more comparatively to some of these other ones. And essentially, as far as I know, and I didn't do a lot of research on this, kind of going off the top of my head a little bit on this, but I think they only minted the pruta, the heavier, you know, equal to a quadrants standard of the pruta. So, all right, next, we're going to cover one of the more interesting aspects of Jewish coinage, and one of probably the most debate, most legend, and one I scratch my head on the most too. That is, and this is something that really kind of predates some of the stuff we're talking about, so we're kind of jumping back in time a little bit here, but we're going to talk about the Tyrian shekels. These were silver coins equal to a shekel, which is actually equal to 4 drachma. And they're produced in Tyre, which is up the coast from Israel. Tyre, Sidon, you might have heard of some of those places, part of the ancient Phoenician Empire. These coins were used in Jerusalem. They were used in the temple. They were used to pay the temple tax. The Jews had a tax. It was a half shekel on each man, I believe is basically the way it worked. And so the coin that was used to pay that was the Tyrian shekel. And so half shekels and shekels, they're bunches of them. And this was the, even officially, the only coin you could give for all the various things that you would pay money for in the temple. Not general offering, you could, like the story of the widow's mite, you could give it. But if there was a requirement in an offering, and there was a few that beyond the temple tax, if there was some type of requirement that you had to pay a shekel or half shekel of silver, this was the only coin acceptable to do it. And these weren't necessarily in circulation. So this is where the money changers came into place. Because you would show up to the temple and they say, oh, you need a Tyrian shekel, you need a shekel to pay your temple tax. Okay, great. Well, let's see. What do you got? We mark it up by, 8% or whatever. I don't remember the exact markup, but basically they marked it up and you would trade your money plus a conversion fee for the shekel to give into the, temple. And this gets into some of what the money changers that Jesus, had his incident with. There's stories I remember reading that, they would call out their different conversion rates and, hey, he's charging 8, we charge 7.5 and, stuff like that. So really, this is kind of a little extra money-making scheme on the side attached to the temple, which part of what angered Christ so much. One of the very interesting things about the shekel, and there's actually a bunch of coins, shekels, this isn't the only shekel out there. There's a bunch of different ones out there, but this one, this particular Tyrian shekel had, on its front, a picture of the Phoenician god Melkart, who we could, depending on where you look, some people say he's kind of their version of Hercules. Some people say he is Baal, kind of the Old Testament Baal. But anyway, he is a false god. And wait a minute, it's somebody's face. Wait a minute, that's a graven image. And wait a minute, the Jews are using that. Yes, does that make sense? Absolutely not. But this was a compromise they made, and we'll talk about that in a second. On the back of it, there's an eagle standing, and there's some writing, and there's a little date system that they would use, that you can actually date these coins based on that date system if you know what you're doing. Shekels, of course, were silver. These were like 95% pure silver, which is pretty high for the time and for the area. That's part of the reason they were accepted, because they were so close to being pure. Weighed about 14 grams. Half shekels are also very common. They're a lot more affordable if you want to collect these things. Tyrian shekels, a good one, very expensive. Very, very expensive. Half shekels are a lot more affordable, and you can get some that are in very bad shape, pretty reasonable. But if these, a good one, they are hundreds of dollars. Okay, so why did the Jews use these coins? Especially in their temple. This wasn't like just, I got this coin from a Roman, what am I going to do with it? They officially sanctioned these coins for use in their most sacred place for one of their most sacred duties. What in the world? Basically, they, convenience, this was one of the more common coins in the area. And it met the standards. It was as pure as they could get. So those factors weighed in. A lot of other coins and stuff were getting to debase their coins, so they may only be 80% silver. So, but basically the Jews, I think it's in the first century B.C., actually, basically, the rabbis got together and said, okay, we are only going to use the shekel because, look, we didn't mint it, so we didn't break the graven image thing. And, because it's being used for holy purposes, well, we can kind of overlook the fact that it has a pagan god on it. So, interestingly, they came to some sort of compromise where they were using this coin that makes really no sense that they would even touch for use in the temple. There's also, by the way, there's also a theory that in about the year 18 BC, Caesar shows up, or I can't remember exactly who it was at the time. I guess that would probably be Caesar Augustus. But basically, the mint at Tyre was shut down. And that from the year 18 BC to AD 65, that the quote-unquote Tyrian shekels were actually being produced in Jerusalem. and they just kept the same style, the same images, and were producing them locally. Now, some of that is conjecture. There is, you know, evidence when you look at these things, there is a change in style, and there's reasons to believe maybe this was the case, but it's still a theory. There really is no concrete proof that I'm aware of, unless something's come up pretty recently on that. But that's a pretty popular theory when it comes to the shekels, that Tyre quit producing them, and we know historically that the mint was shut down, but the coins kept being produced. So where were they being produced at? Or did they get some kind of dispensation where, okay, you can only produce those coins for use in Jerusalem? I don't know. But there was an incident where, you know, Tyre got a slap on the wrist, and the mint being shut down evidently was part of it. So it's just a theory. There's some good evidence for it, but we're still just going to classify it as a theory. Okay, so jumping back to our little order of history where we've talked about the Hasmonean, the Herodian, and the Procurator coins. The next kind of major Jewish coins were the revolt coins. The first revolt, the Great Jewish Revolt, the first revolt, 66 to 70 AD, you know, roughly. And during the revolt, when they revolt against Rome, well, do you think they're going to use Roman coins? No way. They're going to make their own. So they started producing their own coins with their own symbolism, and a lot of these had, you know, like for the freedom of Jerusalem, had very patriotic slogans and stuff on them. They kind of followed the same standards. They had prutas, which were the larger quadrants size. Half shekels and shekels of silver, these are pretty rare, pretty collectible, those the silver shekels. The prutas, you can actually get some of those pretty reasonable. The prutas, especially, they actually would date these things year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. I think they only did five. Year two and three are pretty common. There's a bunch of them, and you can get those pretty reasonable if you want one of these coins. Year one's pretty rare, and by year four and five, Rome was beginning to win, so there are not a lot of those. Those are pretty rare. These were produced a lot of times by rebels. Some cases that, you know, they were melting down other coins to produce these, or in some cases they would actually restamp these. They would actually get a file down the image, and then heat the coin up and then stamp it with a new image. So if you look, you can actually kind of see another coin underneath the image. It's not as much of a deal with the first revolt they did this, but with our next classification, it's very common, and that is the Bar Kokhba coins. And Bar Kokhba led the kind of the last Jewish local revolt, 130 something AD. I didn't put the date on that, but it's about 130. And these were the last Jewish coins that were produced until modern Israel. And Bar Kokhba, these guys on the run, they're in the hills, and they were very sloppy with their coins, but this was a huge, one of the things with coins, it was a huge propaganda value. So these guys really were taking old coins, filing them down, restamping them, you know, so if you look, and sometimes they didn't do a very good job, you can actually see the image underneath the Bar Kokhba image, and very interesting, very collectible. In some cases, they would stamp over the coins, the Judea Capta coins that that the Flavian dynasty, Vespasian and Titus and Domitian produced, you know, celebrating the capture of Judea and defeating them in the Jewish revolt. So there actually are some these Judea Capta coins, which I probably should have thrown in and talked about those. Those are very collectible too. But that where they at the Bar Kokhba revolt got their hands on these coins, which are, you know, like 60 years old and pretty much out of circulation and lost and gone by this time. But they got them and filed them down and then stamped their revolt coins, which makes them just that much more amazing, the history involved. That the coin celebrating the first revolt, the defeat of the first revolt, here they are is being restamped for the last Jewish revolt. It's just amazing. Those are really, really cool. just from a historical standpoint. So, well, and everything else too, they're pretty cool. Bar Kokhba, also an interesting thing about his coins is they even did some silver shekels, which actually have kind of a picture of the Jewish temple on it, which is interesting. Most people alive probably hadn't seen the Jewish temple, but actually have a picture of the temple. And in some cases, there's a couple of types of coins where maybe the doors are open on the temple and maybe inside they actually have a picture of the Ark of the Covenant. It's very hard to tell. It's very small. And some people don't believe that's the case at all. But I'm just going to throw it out there as kind of a theory that those are out there. Well, anyway, that's all the notes I want to cover historically. Let me go ahead and just kind of give you a word on collecting ancient coins. Something I got into. I hadn't bought any in a while. But be a little careful about who you buy it from. You can buy on eBay, but there are some shysters on there selling obvious fakes. Buy from reputable dealers. There's a lot of good ones out there. I'll tell you the first place I would look if you're just new to this to get some information. And I've got a list of sources here we'll talk about in a minute. But there's a man named David Hendin, H-E-N-D-I-N. He has a company called Amphora Coins. And now he's only one of many places, but this guy is considered to be one of the leading experts on Jewish coinage, on ancient Jewish coinage. In fact, his book, which I think is now in its fifth edition, called A Guide to Biblical Coins. I only have the fourth edition. I don't have the newest one. But is considered, you know, one of the best books. And honestly, I learned so much history out of that book. I would recommend it. It's very expensive, very small publication. You're probably going to spend like $75 getting a copy of that book. But well worth it if you get into this, just for the information and the history. But anyway, I would look there. His company's called Amphora Coins. If you just search for David Hendin, you'll find it. But he sells some coins on the side. That'll give you an idea. There's a bunch of other ones. V-Coins, the letter V is in victory. V-Coins.com is an online storefront for a lot of very reputable dealers. That's a good place to look. eBay, just pay attention to who you're buying it from. Or don't spend a lot of money. Be a little careful on eBay. But a lot of these places will give you a certificate of authenticity. If David Hendin will do that. Some of the V-Coins dealers will do that. But, you know, just kind of keep track with who you're buying these things from. There's a lot of auctions and things you can get into. There's a lot of different books on there. I own a couple of other books, but there's a lot of research. A lot of work has been done. And what a coin collector was called a numismatist. I can't even say that one, but the whole field, there's been a lot of work in on ancient coins, and there's people who specialize in Greek coinage and in Roman coinage and, you know, in Jewish coinage. And, you can find a lot of great information out there. There's some pretty good websites out there. Wild Winds is a great one. They've got I think it's still around. I haven't been there in a year or so, but great resource. They kind of have a database of different coins that have been up for sale and will give you information about them and pictures and selling prices. But anyway, it's just fun. Get in there, dig around if you get into it. It's a lot of fun. Something I fell in love with. If I had a little bit more money laying around and, you know, wasn't sitting in a house I haven't even made a payment on yet, I would probably still be, you know, buying some. And, you know, birthdays and stuff, sometimes I still will. But something very interesting to get into. And I would recommend it as a hobby. And it's surprisingly affordable. When you think about it, you think, oh, it's Roman, it's Jewish, it's 2,000 years old, it ought to be worth thousands of dollars. No, in some cases, in fact, a lot of cases, you can get coins for less than $5, less than $10, less than $20. You can actually get some pretty decent looking coins. Less than $100, you'd be surprised at what you can get on places like eBay. Auctions, that's a different story. But places like eBay or V-Coins will have some of the lesser quality coins, and you can get them surprisingly affordable. But anyway, sources, I haven't been very good talking about sources. I might have mentioned them, but in this case, I'm going to give you some. I'm going to have these in the notes. Wikipedia was a major source for a lot of this, just lining out a lot of the history and, you know, weights and values and stuff. A Guide to Biblical Coins by David Hendon. If you want one book on Jewish coins, get that one. And I'd get one of the later editions. Fourth edition, that's one I've got. I like it. I think the first couple weren't nearly as big, but fourth edition isn't too old. The fifth edition just came out like in the last year or two. But it's small printings, and that's one of the things with coin books, small printings, and they're usually pretty expensive. I've got a book called A Treasury of Jewish Coins by Yaakov Mesherer, who was like a Jewish professor, and it's supposed to be one of the best books. Tons of pictures and way over my head. You can get that through David Hendon also. And actually, you go to David Hendon's website, M4Coins. He has books and stuff you can buy through him. Ancient Coin Magazine called The Sellator you can subscribe to. I used to have a subscription to it. Very interesting. A lot of neat history stuff in it. Kind of expensive, though. Couple of websites I use, I've got noted. There's one, dougsmith.ancients.info, has a lot of information on Greek and Roman coins. I've got a reference one I used a little bit for some of the weights and conversions. On BaptistBasics.org, I have a couple of articles on coins. I've got one on coins of the King James Bible. Just go to Baptist Basics. I've got the links in the notes, but if you go to Baptist Basics, go to click on articles, and you'll see these listed. I've got one on coins of the King James Bible, which I explain what coins are being talked about, where the, when the King James Bible says penny or farthing, well, I'm going to tell you what that coin is, what that in the Greek or whatever, but tell you what historically what coin that is, and in most cases have a picture of one of those types of coins. And then also have one kind of on general history and with some other pictures and stuff, and that's a survey of biblical coins. I don't remember exactly what the name of it is, but it's also there. So that's a couple more resources if you want something that I have done. That's some stuff that I've written and put together and some pictures I've taken of some of my personal collection, which I say my collection, it ain't much, and they're not very good quality coins, but still, just amazing, the history of it. I love it. And I think you might can get a feel for that in my voice when I talk about it. That I love the history. I love the affordability of it as a hobby. I do not love how confusing it is between the conversions, between the different systems. You get into, this coin, this Greek coin is worth, to convert it to Roman coinage. Well, then it depends on, what stage of Roman coinage? And it gets very, 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 very confusing. Even, converting different types of Roman coins to values inside Roman coinage, just inside different time periods, gets very confusing. That I still can't wrap my head around. But there's a lot of fantastic history. Now, I'm going to tell you, I have learned more about Jewish history of the 1st and 2nd century, 1st century BC, 1st century AD, through learning about these coins than I have in any other way. I've learned more about the Hasmoneans. I mean, honestly, have you ever heard the word Hasmonean? You probably have not. You've probably heard of the Maccabees. They might get mentioned. But the Hasmonean dynasty, did you know that there was an independent Jewish state that existed in the, for 130 years or so in the 2nd and 1st century BC before Herod came along? You may not have even realized that. You may have thought, since, Babylon came along, the Jews haven't had an independent state. They've been subjugated. Well, they kind of, had some deals and treaties going on to help them be independent, but they were basically an independent state there for about 130 years. That's something I probably would I don't know where I would learn that if it hadn't been for coins. I didn't learn that in college. I didn't learn that in reading. I learned that through studying these coins. And also about the different Roman procurators. And that's one of the things I love about David Hendon's book, is that when he goes to talk about the different people, like the Roman procurators, he's going to tell you the history behind them, some of the stuff that's happened, and give you the quotes out of Josephus and stuff. The one caveat I give about him is that he's a little bit of a critic when it comes to the Bible, and there's certain things he really kind of downplays, like Herod's slaughter of the innocents basically said that never happened. But generally, as a historian, I respect his work. Theology may be another story, and and I'm going to take the Bible's word over his or over Josephus or anybody else. But that's the one little caveat I would give you about David Hendon's book. But overall, as a work, is even beyond the coins, is just a history book. I love his book. Read it front to back. Love it. So anyway, there you go. I'll quit rambling now. That's our lesson on coins and money. I thought about throwing in some stuff about weights and measurements, but I knew this would go a little long. We might throw that in one of the later lessons, but hope it's been a help to you. Hope you've learned something. I was still learning stuff as I was going back in here putting these notes together. So anyway, check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. Like I said, I've got a couple of different things I've put together on coins, so you can go check those out. And especially if you want to see a picture of what some of these coins look like, I've got some pictures of those. I think on these the survey of biblical coins, there's some links on that page to some of the sites that have some of the other ones. I think that's on there. Anyway, I could look it up and look, but I'm not going to. Anyway, but check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. Email me, podcast@BaptistBasics.org. I appreciate reviews on iTunes. Appreciate hearing from you. I do check my email. I get it on my phone. I get it, within 15 minutes of you sending it to me. So, but anyway, I appreciate you listening today. I hope it's been helping and blessing to you. I'm Matthew Gage. I'll see you next time.